All of the people of the spectrum were descended from empath stock. The helix was and is a way to refine that empathic ability. I shook my head. I'm sorry, I don't understand. Please understand this, Rolandimian, said Demria, her fingers squeezing my wrist almost painfully. If you do not escape this place, the Pax will have your soul and body, and the one who teaches needs both these things. I squinted at the woman, thinking that she was jesting, but her pleasant, unlined face was set and serious. Please, said little Bin, setting his little hand in my free one and pulling. Please hurry, Rol. I hurried down the stairs. One of the men in green handed me a red robe. Alem Mikhail helped me fold and wrap it over my own clothes. He wrapped the red burnous and cowl in a dozen quick strokes. I would never have been able to arrange it properly. I realized with a shock that the entire family, the two older women, teenage Tess Ambry and little Bin, had stripped naked from their blue robes and were arranging red ones around them. I saw then that I had been wrong, thinking that they were like Lusians. For although their bodies were shorter than pack space average and heavily muscled, they were perfectly proportioned. None of the adults had any hair, either on their heads or elsewhere. Somehow this made their compact, perfectly toned bodies more attractive. I looked away, realizing that I was blushing. Cess Ambry laughed and jostled my arm. We were all in red robes now, Alem Mikhail being the last to pull his on. One glance at his heavily muscled upper torso told me that I would not last 15 seconds in a fight with the shorter man. But then I realized I probably would not last more than 30 seconds with Demloa or Demria either. I offered the flechette pistol to Alem, but he gestured for me to keep it, and showed me how to tuck it in one of the multiple sashes of the long crimson robe. I thought of my lack of weapons in the little backpack, a Navajo hunting knife and the little flashlight laser, and nodded my gratitude. The women and children and I were hurried into the back of the windcycle wagon that held my kayak, and red fabric was pulled tight over the stays above us. We had to crouch low as a second layer of fabric, some wooden planks, and various crates and barrels were set in around and above us. I could just make out a glimpse of light between the tailgate and the wagon cover. I listened to footsteps on stone as Alem went up front and crawled onto one of the two pedaling saddles. I listened as one of the other men, also now in a red robe, joined him on the cycling seat on the other side of the central yoke. With the masts still lowered above us, fabric sails reefed, we began rolling up a long ramp out of the garage. "Where are we going?" I whispered to Demria, who was lying almost next to me. The wood smelled like cedar.
"The downstream forecaster arch," she whispered back.
I blinked. "You know about that?"
"They gave you truth tell," whispered Dem Loa from the other side of a crate. "And you did speak in your sleep."
Bin was lying right next to me in the darkness.
"We know the one who teaches has sent you on a mission," he said almost happily. "We know you have to get to the next arch."
He patted the kayak that curved next to us.
"I wish I could go with you."
"This is too dangerous," I hissed, feeling the wagon roll out of the tunnel and into open air. Low sunlight illuminated the fabric above us. The windcycle wagon stopped for a second as the two men cranked the mast erect and unfurled the sail. "Too dangerous." I meant them taking me to the forecaster, of course, not the mission that Ania had sent me on. "If they know who I am," I whispered to Demria, "they'll be watching the arch." I could see the silhouette of her cowl as she nodded.
"They will be watching, Rolandimian, and it is dangerous, but darkness is almost here in 14 minutes.
I glanced at my comm log. It would be another 90 minutes or more until twilight, according to what I had observed the previous 2 days, and then almost another full hour until true nightfall.
"It is only 6 kilometers to the downstream arch," whispered Cess Ambry from her place on the other side of the kayak. "The villages will be filled with the spectrum celebrating."
I understood then. "The twice darkness," I whispered.
"Yes," said Demria. She patted my hand. "We must be silent now. We will be moving into traffic along the saltway."
"Too dangerous,"
I whispered one last time as the wagon began creaking and groaning its way into traffic. I could hear the chain drive rumbling beneath the buckboard floor and feel the wind catch the sail. "Too dangerous," I said only to myself. If I had known what was happening a few hundred meters away, I would have realized how truly dangerous this moment was. I peered out through the gap between wagon wood and fabric as we rumbled along the saltway. This vehicle thoroughfare appeared to be a strip of rock-hard salt between the villages clustered along the raised canal and the reticulated desert stretching as far north as I could see. "Waste, Wahabi," whispered Demaria as we picked up speed and headed south along the saltway. Other wind cycle wagons roared past, heading south, their sails fully engaged, their two peddlers working madly. Even more brightly canvassed wagons tacked north, their sails set differently, the peddlers leaning far out for balance as the creaking wagons teetered on two wheels, the other two spinning uselessly in the air. We covered the 6 kilometers in 10 minutes and turned off the saltway onto a paved ramp that led through a cluster of homes. White stone this time, not adobe. And then Alem and the other man furled the sail and pedaled the wind cycle slowly along the cobblestone street that ran between the homes and the canal river. High, wispy ferns grew along the canal banks there between elaborately fashioned piers, gazebos, and multi-tiered docks to which were tied ornate houseboats. The city seemed to end here where the canal widened into a waterway, much more river-like than artificial. And I raised my head enough to see the huge Farcaster arch a few hundred meters downstream. Through and beyond the rusted arch, I could see only fern forest on the riverbanks and desert waste to the east and west. Alem guided the wind cycle onto a brick loading ramp and pulled under the cover of a copse of tall ferns. I glanced at my comm log, less than 2 minutes until the twice darkness. At that instant, there was a rush of warm air and a shadow passed over us. We all crouched lower as the black pack skimmer flew out over the river at an altitude of less than 100 meters. The aerodynamic figure-eight shape of the thing, clearly visible as it banked more steeply, and then swooped low above the ships headed north and south through the arch. River traffic was brisk here where the river widened. Sleek racing sculls with rowing teams of 4 to 12, gleaming powerboats throwing up glistening wakes, sailboats ranging from single-person jitabouts to wallowing square-sailed junks, canoes and rowboats, some stately houseboats churning against the current, a handful of silent electric hovercraft moving within their halos of spray, and even some rafts that reminded me of my earlier voyage with Aenea and Abetic. The skimmer flew low over these ships, passed over the Farcaster arch headed south, flew back under it headed north, and disappeared in the direction of Lochchild Lomond. "Come," said Alem Mikhail, folding back the fabric tarp above us and pulling at the kayak. "We must hurry." Suddenly there was a rush of warm air, followed by a cooler breeze that kicked dust off the riverbank. The fern heads rustled and shook above us, and the sky grew purple and then black. Stars came out. I glanced upward just long enough to see a beaded corona around one of the moons and the burning disk of the second lower satellite as it moved into place behind the first. From north along the river, back in the direction of the linear city that included Lochchild Lomond, there came the most haunting and mournful sound I had ever heard. A long wailing, more human-throated than siren caused, followed by a sustained note that grew deeper and deeper until it fell into the subsonic. I realized that I had heard hundreds, perhaps thousands, of horns played at the same instant that thousands, perhaps tens of thousands, of human voices had joined in chorus. The darkness around us grew deeper. The stars blazed. The disk of the lower moon was like some great backlit dome that threatened to drop on the darkened world at any moment. Suddenly, the many ships on the river to the south and the canal river to the north began wailing with their own sirens and horns. A cacophonous howl this, nothing like the descending harmony of the opening chorus, and then began firing off flares and fireworks.
Multicolored star shells, roaring St. Catherine's wheels, red parachute flares, braided strands of yellow, blue, green, red, and white fire, the spectrum helix, and countless aerial bombs. The noise and light were all but overwhelming. "Hurry," repeated Alem, pulling the kayak from the wagon bed. I jumped out to help him and pulled off my concealing robe, tossing it into the back of the wagon. The next minute was a flurry of coordinated motion as Demria, Demloa, Sesambri, Bin, and I helped Alem and the unnamed man carry the kayak down to the river's edge and set it afloat. I went into the warm water up to my knees, stowed my backpack and the flechette pistol inside the little cockpit, held the kayak steady against the current, and looked at the two women, two young people, and two men in their billowing robes. "What is to happen to you?" I asked. My back ached from the aftermath of the kidney stone, but at the moment the tightening of my throat was the more painful distraction. Demria shook her head. "Nothing bad will happen to us, Rol Endymion. If the Pax authorities attempt to make trouble, we will simply disappear into the tunnels beneath Waste Wahabi until it is time to rejoin the spectrum elsewhere." She smiled and adjusted her robe on her shoulder. "But make us one promise, Rol Endymion."
"Anything," I said. "If I can do it, I will."
"If it is possible, ask the one who teaches to return with you to Vitus Grey Balianus B, and the people of the Amoyeti Spectrum Helix. We shall try not to convert to the Pax's Christianity until she comes to speak to us." I nodded, looking at Bin Rhea Dem Loa Alem's shaven skull, his red cowl flapping around him in the breeze, his cheeks gaunt with chemotherapy, his eyes gleaming more with excitement than reflected fireworks. "Yes," I said. "If it is at all possible, I will do that." They all touched me then, not to shake hands, but merely to touch, fingers against my vest or arm or face or back. I touched them back, turned the bow of the kayak into the current, and stepped into the cockpit. The paddle was in the hull clamp where I had left it. I tightened the cockpit skirt around me, as if there were white water ahead, bumped my hand against the clear plastic cover over the red panic button that Ania had shown me as I set the pistol on the cockpit skirt. If this interlude had not caused me to panic, I was not sure what could, held the paddle in my left hand and waved farewell with my right. The six-robed figures blended into the shadows beneath the ferns as the kayak swept out into the middle current. The Farcaster arch grew larger. Overhead, the first moon began to move beyond the disk of the sun, but the second, larger moon moved to cover both with its bulk. The fireworks and siren sounds continued, even grew in ferocity. I paddled closer to the right bank as I came closer to the Farcaster, trying to stay in the small boat traffic headed downstream, but not too close to anyone. "If they are going to intercept me," I thought, "they will do it here." Without thinking, I raised the flechette pistol onto the curve of hull in front of me. The swift current had me now, and I set the paddle in its bracket and waited to pass under the Farcaster. No other ships or small boats would be under the Farcaster when it activated. Above me, the arch was a curve of blackness against the starry sky. Suddenly, there was violent commotion on the riverbank not 20 meters to my right. I raised the pistol and stared, not understanding what I was seeing and hearing. Two explosions like sonic booms, strobe flashes of white light. More fireworks? No, these flashes were much brighter. Energy weapons fire? Too bright. Too unfocused. It was more like small plasma explosives going off. Then I saw something in a blink of an eye, more a retinal echo than a true vision. Two figures locked in a violent embrace, images reversed like a negative of an ancient photograph. Sudden violent motion, another sonic boom, a flash of white that blinded me even before the image had registered in my brain. Spikes, thorns, two heads butting together, six arms flailing, sparks flying, a human form and something larger. The sound of metal rending, the sound of something or someone screaming, with a voice louder than the sirens wailing on the river behind me. The shockwave from whatever was happening on the bank rippled out across the river, almost tumbled my kayak, and proceeded across the water like a curtain of white spray. Then I was under the Farcaster arch. There was the flash and instant vertigo I had known before. A bright light surrounded me through the flash bulb brightness, and the kayak and I were falling. Truly falling, tumbling into space. A section of water that had been forecast under me fell away into a brief waterfall. But then the kayak was falling free from the water, spinning as it fell, and in my panic I dropped the flechette pistol into the cockpit and grabbed the hull of the kayak, setting it spinning more wildly as it fell. I blinked through the flash echoes and tried to see how far I had to fall, even as the kayak went bow down and picked up speed. Blue sky above, clouds all around, huge clouds, stratocumulus rising thousands of meters above and falling more thousands of meters below. Cirrus many kilometers above me, black thunderstorms many more kilometers below. There was nothing but sky and I was falling into it. Beneath me, the brief waterfall from the river had separated into giant teardrops of moisture, as if someone had taken 100 buckets of water and hurled them into a bottomless chasm. The kayak spun and threatened to go stern over bow. I shifted forward in the little kayak and almost tumbled out, with only my crossed legs and the lashing of the little moisture skirt holding me in. I grabbed the rim of the cockpit in a white-knuckled, hopeless grip. Cold air whipped and roared around me as the kayak and I picked up speed, hurtling toward terminal velocity. Thousands and thousands of meters of empty, open air lay between me and the lightning-darted clouds so far below. The two-bladed paddle ripped from its bracket and tumbled away in free fall. I did the only thing I could do under the circumstances. I opened my mouth and screamed.
Audible Frontiers presents The Rise of Endymion, written by Dan Simmons and read by Victor Bavine.
Chapter 11. Kenzo Isozaki could say honestly that he had never been afraid before in his life. Raised as a business samurai in the Fern Islands of Fuji, he had been taught and trained since infancy to be disdainful of fear and contemptuous of anyone who felt it. Caution he allowed. It had become an indispensable business tool for him. But fear was alien to his nature and his carefully constructed personality. Until this moment. M. Isozaki stood back while the inner door of the airlock cycled open. Whatever awaited within had been on the surface of an airless, tumbling asteroid a minute earlier, and it was not wearing a spacesuit. Isozaki had chosen not to bring a weapon on the little asteroid hopper. Neither he nor the ship was armed. At this moment, as ice crystals billowed like fog from the opening airlock and a humanoid figure stepped through, Kenzo Isozaki wondered if that had been a wise choice. The humanoid figure was human, or at least human in appearance. Tan skin, neatly cut gray hair, a perfectly tailored gray suit, gray eyes under lashes still rimmed with frost, and a white smile. "M. Isozaki?" said Counselor Albedo. Isozaki bowed. He had brought his heart rate and breathing under his control, and now he concentrated on keeping his voice flat, level, and emotionless. "It's kind of you to respond to my invitation." Albedo crossed his arms. The smile remained on the tanned, handsome face, but Isozaki was not fooled by it. The seas around the Fern Islands of Fuji were thick with sharks descended from the DNA recipes and frozen embryos of the early Bussard seed ships. "Invitation?" said Counselor Albedo in a rich voice. "Or summons?" Isozaki's head remained slightly bowed. His hands hung loosely at his sides. Never a summons, M.
You know my name, I think, said Albedo.
The rumors say that you are the same Counselor Albedo who advised Mayna Gladstone almost 3 centuries ago, sir, said the CEO of the Pax Mercantilis.
I was more hologram than substance then, said Albedo, uncrossing his arms. But the personality is the same. And you need not call me sir.
Isozaki bowed slightly. Counselor Albedo stepped deeper into the little hopper. He ran his powerful fingers over consoles and the single pilot's couch and the rim of its empty high-G tank.
A modest chip for such a powerful person, M. Isozaki.
I thought it best to exercise discretion, Counselor. May I call you that? Instead of answering, Albedo took an aggressive step closer to the CEO. Isozaki did not flinch.
Did you feel it an act of discretion to release an AI viral telotaxis into Pachim's crude datasphere so that it could go looking for technocore nodes?
Albedo's voice filled the hopper cabin. Kenzo Isozaki raised his eyes to meet the gray glare of the taller man.
Yes, Counselor. If the Corps still existed, it was imperative that that the Mercantilis make personal contact. The telotaxis was programmed to self-destruct if detected by PAC's antiviral programs, and to inoculate only if it received an unmistakable Corps response.
Counselor Albedo laughed.
Your AI telotaxis was about as subtle as the metaphorical turd in the proverbial punch bowl, Isozaki-san.
The Mercantilis CEO blinked in surprise at the crudity. Albedo dropped into the acceleration couch, stretched, and said,
Sit down, my friend. You went to all that trouble to find us. You risked torture, excommunication, real execution, and the loss of your parking privileges in the Vatican Skimmer Park. You want to talk? Talk.
Temporarily off balance, Isozaki looked for another surface on which to sit. He settled on a clear section of the plotting board. He disliked zero-G, so the crude internal containment field kept up a differential simulating one gravity. But the effect was inconsistent enough to keep Isozaki teetering on the edge of vertigo. He took a breath and gathered his thoughts.
"You are serving the Vatican," he began.
Albedo interrupted at once.
"The Corps serves no one, Mercantilis man."
Isozaki took another breath and began again.
Your interests and the Vatican's have overlapped to the point that the Technocore provides counsel and technology, vital to the survival of the Pax.
Counselor Albedo smiled and waited. Thinking, for what I will say next, His Holiness will feed me to the Grand Inquisitor. I will be on the pain machine for 100 lifetimes, Isozaki said.
Some of us within the Executive Council of the Pan-Capitalist League of Independent Catholic Transstellar Trade Organizations feel that the interests of the League and the interests of the Technocore may well hold more in common than those of the Corps and the Vatican. We feel that an, investigation of those common goals and interests would be beneficial to both parties.
Counselor Albedo showed more of his perfect teeth. He said nothing. Feeling the hemp-like texture of the noose he was placing around his own neck, Isozaki said,
For 2¾ centuries, the Church and the PAC civil authorities have held as official policy that the Technocore was destroyed in the fall of the Farcasters. Millions of those close to power on worlds across PAX space know the rumors of the Corps' survival.
The rumors of our death are greatly exaggerated, said Counselor Albedo. So?
So, continued Isozaki, with the full understanding that this alliance between Corps personalities and the Vatican has been beneficial to both parties, Counselor. The League would like to suggest ways in which a similar direct alliance with our trading organization would bring more immediate and tangible benefits to your, society.
Suggest away, Isozaki-san, said Counselor Albedo, leaning farther back in the pilot's chair.
One,
said Isozaki, his voice growing firmer. The Pax Mercantilis is expanding in ways which no religious organization can hope to do, however hierarchical or universally accepted it might be. Capitalism is regaining power throughout the Pax. It is the true glue that holds the hundreds of worlds together. 2. The Church continues to carry on its endless war with the Ousters and with rebellious elements within the Pax sphere of influence. The Pax Mercantilis views all such conflicts as a waste of energy and precious human and material resources. More importantly, it involves the Technocore in human squabbles that can neither further core interests nor advance core goals. 3. While the Church and the Pax utilize such obviously core-derived technologies as the instantaneous Gideon Drive and the Resurrection Creches, the Church gives the Technocore no credit for these inventions. Indeed, the Church still holds the Core up as an enemy to its billions of faithful, portraying the Core entities as having been destroyed because they were in league with the devil. The Pax Mercantilis has no need for such prejudice and artifice. If the Core were to choose continued concealment when allied with us, we should honor that policy, always willing to present the Core as visible and appreciated partners when and if you should so decide. In the meantime, however, the League would move to end, for now and forever, the demonization of the Technocore in history, lore, and the minds of human beings everywhere. Counselor Albedo looked thoughtful. After a moment of gazing out the port at the tumbling asteroid beyond, he said,
"So you will make us rich and respectable?"
Kenzo Isozaki said nothing. He felt that his future and the balance of power in human space was teetering on a knife's edge. He could not read Albedo. The cybrid's sarcasm could well be a prelude to negotiation.
"What would we do with the Church?" asked Albedo. "More than 2.5 human centuries of silent partnership."
Isozaki willed his heart rate to slow again. "We do not wish to interrupt any relationship which the Corps has found useful or profitable," he said softly. "As business people, we in the League are trained to see the limitations of any religion-based interstellar society. Dogma and hierarchy are endemic to such structures. Indeed, such are the structures of any theocracy. As business people dedicated to the mutual profit of ourselves and our business associates, we see ways in which a second level of core human cooperation, however secretive or limited, should and would be beneficial to both parties." Counselor Albedo nodded again.
"Isozaki-san, do you remember in your private office in the Taurus, when you had your associate, Anna Pelli Cognani, remove her clothes?"
Isozaki retained a neutral expression, but only by the utmost effort of will. The fact that the Corps was looking into his private office, recording every transaction, made his blood literally chill.
"You asked then," continued Albedo, "why we had helped the Church refine the cruciform. To what ends, I believe you said? What is the benefit to the Corps?"
Isozaki watched the man in gray, but more than ever he felt that he was locked in the little asteroid hopper with a cobra that had reared up and opened its hood.
"Have you ever owned a dog, Isozaki-san?" asked Albedo.
Still thinking about cobras, the Mercantilis CEO could only stare.
"A dog?" he said after a moment.
"No, not personally. Dogs were not common on my home world."
"Ah, that's right," said Albedo, showing his white teeth again. "Sharks were the pet of choice on your island. I believe that you had a baby shark which you tried to tame when you were about 6 standard years old. You named it Keigo, if I am not mistaken."
Isozaki could not have spoken if his life had depended upon it at that second.
"And how did you keep your growing baby shark from eating you when you swam together in the Shioko Lagoon, Isozaki-san?"
After a moment of trying, Isozaki managed, "Caller."
"I beg your pardon?"
Counselor Albedo leaned closer.
"Caller," said the CEO. Small, perfectly black spots were dancing in the periphery of his vision.
Shock collar. We had to carry the transmitter palm keys, the same devices our fishermen used.
Ah, yes, said Albedo, still smiling. If your pet did something naughty, you brought it back into line, with just a touch of your finger.
He held his hand out, cupping it as if he were cradling an invisible palm key. His tanned finger came down on an invisible button. It was not so much like an electrical shock passing through Kenzo Isozaki's body, more like radiating waves of pure, unadulterated agony, beginning in his chest, beginning in the cruciform embedded under his skin and flesh and bone, and radiating out like telegraph signals of pain, flowing through the hundreds of meters of fibers and nematodes and clustered nodes of cruciform tissue, metastasized through his body like rooted tumors. Isozaki screamed and doubled over in pain. He collapsed to the floor of the hopper.
I believe that your palm keys could give old Kaigo increasing jolts if he got aggressive, mused Counselor Albedo. Wasn't that the case, Isozaki-san?
His fingers tapped at empty air again, as if cueing a palm key. The pain grew worse. Isozaki urinated in his ship suit and would have voided his bowels if they had not been already empty. He tried to scream again, but his jaws clamped tight as if from violent tetanus. Enamel on his teeth cracked and chipped away. He tasted blood as he bit through a corner of his tongue.
On a scale of 10, that would have been about a 2 for old Kaigo, I think, said Counselor Albedo.
He stood and walked to the airlock, tapping the cycling combination in. Writhing on the floor, his body and brain useless appendages to a cruciform of horrific pain radiating through his body. Isozaki tried to scream through his locked jaws. His eyes were swelling out of their sockets. Blood ran from his nose and ears. Finished with cycling the airlock combination, Counselor Albedo tapped at the invisible key in his palm once again. The pain vanished. Isozaki vomited across the deck plates. Every muscle in his body twitched randomly, while his nerves seemed to misfire.
I will bring your proposal to the three elements of the Technocorps, Counselor Albedo said formally. The proposition will be discussed and considered most seriously. In the meantime, my friend, your discretion will be counted upon.
Isozaki tried to make an intelligible noise, but he could only curl up and retch on the metal floor. To his horror, his spasming bowels were passing wind in a ripple of flatulence.
And there will be no more AI viral telotaxis released in anyone's datasphere, will there, Isozaki-san?
Albedo stepped into the airlock and cycled the door shut. Outside the port, the slashed rock of the unnamed asteroid tumbled and spun in dynamics known only to the gods of chaos mathematics. It took Radamanth Nemes and her three siblings only a few minutes to fly the dropship from Pax Base Bombacino to the village of Lochchild Lamond on the slate-dry world of Vitis Grey Balianis B. But the trip was complicated by the presence of three military skimmers that meddling fool Commander Solznikov had sent along in escort. Nemes knew from the secure tight-beam traffic between the base and the skimmers that the base commander had sent his aide, the bumbling Colonel Venara, to take personal charge of the expedition. More than that, Nemes knew that the colonel would be in charge of nothing. That is, Venara would be so wired with real-time holosim pickups and tight-beam squirters that Solznikov would be in actual command of the Pax troopers without showing his jowled face again. By the time they were hovering over the proper village, although village seemed too formal a term for the four-tiered strip of adobe houses that ran along the west side of the river, just as hundreds of other homes had for almost the entire way between the base and here. The skimmers had caught up and were spiraling in for a landing while Nemes looked for a site large enough and firm enough to hold the dropship. The doors of the adobe homes were painted bright primary colors.
People on the street wore robes of the same hue. Nemes knew the reason for this display of color. She had accessed both their ship's memory and the encrypted Bombacino files on the Spectrum Helix people. The data was interesting only in that it suggested that these human oddities were slow to convert to the cross, slower still to submit to Pax control. Likely, in other words, to help a rebellious child, man, and one-armed android hide from the authorities. The skimmers landed on the dike road bordering the canal. Nemes brought the dropship down in a park, partially destroying an artesian well. Gyges shifted in his co-pilot seat and raised an eyebrow.
"Scylla and Briareus will go out to make the formal search," Nemes said aloud. "You stay here with me."
She had noted with no pride or vanity that her clone siblings had long since submitted to her authority, despite the death threat they had brought from the Three Elements and the certainty of it being carried out if she were to fail again. The other female and male went down the ramp and through the crowd of brightly robed people. Troopers in combat armor, visors sealed, jogged to meet them. Watching on the common optic channel, not via tight beam or vid pickup, Nemes recognized Colonel Venara's voice through his helmet speaker.
"The mayor, a woman named Cess Gia, refuses permission for us to search the houses."
Nemes could see Briaris's contemptuous smile reflected on the colonel's polished visor. It was like looking at a reflection of herself with slightly stronger bone structure.
"And you allow this mayor to dictate to you?" said Briareus.
Colonel Venara raised a gauntleted hand.
"The Pax recognizes the indigenous authorities until they have become part of the Pax protectorate," Scylla said.
"You said that Dr. Molina left a Pax trooper as guard."
Venara nodded. His breathing was amplified through the morphic amber helmet.
"There is no sign of that trooper. We have attempted to establish communication since we left Bombacino."
"Doesn't this trooper have a trace chip surgically implanted?" said Scylla.
"No, it is woven into his impact armor."
"And?"
"We found the armor in a well several streets over," said Colonel Venara.
Scylla's voice remained level.
"I presume the trooper was not in the armor."
"No," said the colonel. "Just the armor and helmet. There was no body in the well."
"Pity," said Scylla.
She started to turn away, but then looked back at the Pax colonel.
"Just armor, you say? No weapon?"
"No."
Venara's voice was gloomy.
"I've ordered a search of the streets, and we will question the citizens until someone volunteers the location of the house where the missing spacer was put under arrest by Dr. Molina. Then we will surround it and demand the surrender of all inside. I have, requested the civil courts in Bombacino consider our request for a search warrant."
Briareus said,
"Good plan, Colonel. If the glaciers don't arrive first and cover the village before the warrant is issued."
"Glaciers?" said Colonel Venara.
"Never mind," said Scylla. "If it is acceptable to you, we shall help you search the adjoining streets and await proper authorization for a house-to-house search."
To Nemes, she broadcast on the internal band.
"Now what?" "Stay with him and do just what you offered," sent Nemes. "Be courteous and law-abiding. We don't want to find Endymion or the girl with these idiots around. Gyges and I will go to Fast Time."
"Good hunting,"
sent Briareus. Gyges was already waiting at the dropship lock.
Nemes said, "I'll take the town. You move downriver to the Farcaster Arch and make sure that nothing gets through, going upriver or down, without your checking it out. Phase down to send a squirt message, and I'll shift periodically to check the band. If you find him or the girl, ping me."
It was possible to communicate via common band while phase shifted, but the energy expenditure was so horribly high, above and beyond the unimaginable energy needed just for the phase shift, that it was infinitely more economical to shift down at intervals to check the common band. Even a ping alarm would use the equivalent of this world's entire energy budget for a year. Gyges nodded, and the two phase shifted in unison, becoming chrome sculptures of a naked male and female. Outside the lock, the air seemed to thicken and the light deepen. Sound ceased. Movement stopped. Human figures became slightly out-of-focus statues, with their wind-rippled robes stiff and frozen like the trappings on bronze sculptures. Nemes did not understand the physics of phase shifting. She did not have to understand it in order to use it. She knew that it was neither the anti-entropic nor hyper-entropic manipulation of time. Although the future UI had both of those seemingly magical technologies at its command, nor some sort of speeding up that would have had sonic booms crashing and the air temperature boiling in their wake. But that phase shifting was a sort of sidestepping into the hollowed-out boundaries of space-time.
"You will become, in the nicest sense, rats scurrying in the walls of the rooms of time," had said the core entity most responsible for her creation.
Nemes was not offended by the comparison. She knew the unimaginable amounts of energy that had to be transferred from the core via the void which binds to her or her siblings when they phase-shifted. The elements had to respect even their own instruments to divert so much energy in their direction. The two reflective figures jogged down the ramp and went opposite directions. Gaiji south toward the Farcaster, Nemes past her frozen siblings and the sculptures of Pax troopers and Spectrum citizens into the Adobe City. It took her literally no time at all to find the house with the handcuffed Pax trooper asleep in the corner bedroom facing the canal. She rummaged through the downloaded Pax-based Bombacino files to identify the sleeping trooper, a Lusian named Garen Potts, 38 standard years old, a lazy, initiative-free alcohol addict, 2 years away from retirement, 6 demotions and 3 sentences to brig time in his file, assignments relegated to garrison duty and the most mundane base tasks. And then she deleted the file. The trooper was of no interest to her. Checking once to make sure that the house was empty, Radamanth Nemes dropped out of phase shift and stood a moment in the bedroom. Sound and movement returned. The snoring of the handcuffed trooper, movement of pedestrians along the canal walk, a soft breeze stirring white curtains, the rumble of distant traffic, and even the samurai armor rustles of the Pax troopers jogging through adjoining streets and alleys in their useless search. Standing over the Pax trooper, Nemes extended her hand and first finger as if pointing at the man's neck. A needle emerged from under her fingernail and extended the 10 centimeters to the sleeping man's neck, sliding under the skin and flesh with only the slightest speck of blood to show the intrusion. The trooper did not wake. Nemes withdrew the needle and examined the blood within. Dangerous levels of C27H45OH. Lusians frequently were at risk from high cholesterol, as well as a low platelet count, suggesting the presence of incipient immune thrombocytopenic purpura, probably brought about by the trooper's early years in hard radiation environments on any of several garrison worlds. A blood alcohol level of 122 milligrams over 100 milliliters. The trooper was drunk, although his alcoholic past probably allowed him to hide most of the effects. And voila! The presence of the artificial opiate called Ultramorph, mixed with heightened levels of caffeine. Nemes smiled. Someone had drugged the trooper with sleep-inducing amounts of Ultramorph mixed with tea or coffee, but had done so while taking care to keep the levels below a dangerous overdose. She sniffed the air. Nemes's ability to detect and identify distinct airborne organic molecules, that is, her sense of smell, was about 3 times more sensitive than a typical gas chromatograph mass spectrometer's. In other words, somewhere above that of the old Earth canine called a bloodhound. The room was filled with the distinctive scents of many people. Some of the smells were old, a few were very recent. She identified the Lusian trooper's alcoholic stink, several subtle, musky female scents, the molecular imprint of at least 2 children, one deeply into puberty and the other younger but afflicted with some cancer requiring chemotherapy, and 2 adult males, one bearing the distinct sweat impressions of the diet of this planet, the other being at once familiar and alien. Alien, because the man still carried the scent of a world Nemes had never visited. Familiar, because it was the distinctive human smell she had filed away. Rawl Endymion still carrying the scent of old Earth with him. Nemes walked from room to room, but there was no hint of the peculiar scent she had encountered 4 years earlier of the girl named Anea, nor the antiseptic android smell of a servant called Abetic. Only Rawl Endymion had been here, but he had been here only moments before. Nemes followed the scent trail to the trap door beneath the hall flooring. Ripping the door open despite its multiple locks, she paused before descending the ladder. She squirted the information on the common band, not receiving a responding ping from Gyges, who was probably phase-shifted. It had been only 90 seconds since they had left the ship. Nemes smiled. She could ping Gyges, and he would be here before Rawl Endymion and the others in the tunnel below had taken another 10 heartbeats. But Radamanth Nemes would like to settle this score alone. Still smiling, she jumped into the hole and dropped 8 meters to the tunnel floor below. The tunnel was lighted. Nemes sniffed the cool air, separating the adrenaline-rich scent of Rawl Endymion from the other human odors. The Hyperion-born fugitive was nervous, and he had been ill or injured. Nemes picked up the underlying smell of sweat tinged with ultramorph. Endymion had certainly been the off-worlder treated by Dr. Molina, and someone had used painkillers prescribed for him on the hapless Lusian trooper. Nemes phase-shifted and began jogging down a tunnel now filled with thickened light. No matter how much of a head start Endymion and his allies had on her, she would catch them now. It would have pleased Nemes to slice the troublemaker's head off while she was still phase-shifted. The decapitation seeming supernatural to the real-time onlookers, performed by an invisible executioner. But she needed information from Rawl Endymion. She did not need him conscious, however. The simplest plan would be to pluck him away from his Spectrum Helix friends, surrounding him with the same phased field that protected Nemes, drive a needle into his brain to immobilize him, return him to the dropship, stow him in the resurrection creche there, and then go through the charade of thanking Colonel Venara and Commander Solznikov for their help. They could interrogate Rawl Endymion once their ship had left orbit. Nemes would run microfibers into the man's brain, extracting RNA and memories at will. Endymion would never regain consciousness. When she and her siblings had learned what they needed from his memories, she would terminate him and dump the body into space. The goal was to find the child named Anea. Suddenly, the lights went out. "While I am phase-shifted," thought Nemes, "impossible. Nothing could happen that quickly." She skidded to a halt. There was no light at all in the tunnel, nothing she could amplify. She switched to infrared, scanning the passageway ahead and behind her. Empty. She opened her mouth and emitted a sonar scream, turning quickly to do the same behind her. Emptiness. The ultrasound shriek echoing back off the ends of the tunnel. She modified the field around her to blast a deep radar pulse in both directions. The tunnel was empty, but the deep radar recorded mazes of similar tunnels for kilometers in all directions. 30 meters ahead, beyond a thick metal door, there was an underground garage with an assortment of vehicles and human forms in it. Still suspicious, Nemes dropped out of phase shift for an instant to see how the lights could have gone out in a microsecond. The form was directly in front of her. Nemes had less than a 10,000th of a second to phase shift again as 4 bladed fists struck her with the force of 100,000 pile drivers. She was driven back the length of the tunnel, through the splintering ladder, through the tunnel wall of solid rock and deep into the stone itself. The lights stayed out. In the 20 standard days during which the Grand Inquisitor stayed on Mars, he learned to hate it far more than he thought he could ever hate hell itself. The Simoom planetary dust storm blew every day he was there, despite the fact that he and his 21-person team had taken over the governor's palace on the outskirts of the city of St. Malachy, and despite the fact that the palace was theoretically as hermetically sealed as a Pax spaceship, its air filtered and boosted and refiltered, its windows consisting of 52 layers of high-impact plastic, its entrances more airlock seals than doors. The Martian dust got in. When John Domenico Cardinal Mustafa took his needle shower in the morning, the dust he had accumulated in the night ran in red rivulets of mud into the shower drain. When the Grand Inquisitor's valet helped him pull on his cassock and robes in the morning, all of the clothing fresh cleaned during the night, there were already traces of red grit in the silken folds. As Mustafa ate breakfast, alone in the governor's dining room, grit ground between his molars. During the Holy Office interviews and interrogations held in the echoing great ballroom of the palace, the Grand Inquisitor could feel the dust building up in his ankle hose and collar and hair and under his perfectly manicured fingernails. Outside, it was ridiculous. Skimmers and scorpions were grounded. The spaceport operated only a few hours of the day, during the rare lulls in the simoom. Parked ground vehicles soon became humps and drifts of red sand, and even Pax-quality filters could not keep the red particles out of the engines and motors and solid-state modules. A few ancient crawlers and rovers and fusion rocket shuttles kept food and information flowing to and from the capital. But to all intents and purposes, the Pax government and military on Mars had come to a standstill. It was on the fifth day of the simoom that reports came in of Palestinian attacks on Pax bases on the Tharsis Plateau. Major Piet, the governor's laconic ground force commander, took a company of mixed Pax and home guard troopers and set out in crawlers and tracked APCs. They were ambushed 100 clicks short of the plateau approach, and only Piet and half his command returned to St. Malachy. By the second week, reports came in of Palestinian attacks on a dozen garrison posts in both hemispheres. All contact was lost with the Hellas contingent, and the South Polar Station radioed the Jibril that it was preparing to surrender to the attacking forces. Governor Claire Palo, working out of a small office that had belonged to one of her aides, conferred with Archbishop Robeson and the Grand Inquisitor and released tactical fusion and plasma weapons to the beleaguered garrisons. Cardinal Mustafa agreed to the use of the Jibril as a weapons platform in the struggle against the Palestinians, and South Polar One was slagged from orbit. The Home Guard, Pax, Fleet Marines, Swiss Guard, and Holy Office commands concentrated on making sure that the capital of St. Malachy, its cathedral, and the governor's palace were secure from attack. In the relentless dust storm, any indigene that approached within 8 clicks of the city perimeter and who was not wearing a Pax-issued transponder was lanced, and the bodies were recovered later. A few were Palestinian guerrillas.
"The simoom can't last forever,"
grumbled Commander Browning, the head of the Holy Office security forces.
"It can last another 3 to 4 standard months," said Major Piet, his upper torso bulky in a burn cast. "Perhaps longer."
The work of the Holy Office Inquisition was going nowhere. The militia troopers who had first discovered the massacre in Arafat Kafia were interviewed again under truth-tell and neuroprobe. But their stories remained the same. The Holy Office forensic experts worked with the coroners at St. Malachy's infirmary, only to confirm that none of the 362 corpses could be resurrected. The Shrike had ripped out every node and millifiber of their cruciforms. Queries were sent back to Pacham via instantaneous drive drone regarding the identities of the victims and, more importantly, the nature of the Opus Dei operations on Mars, and the reasons for the advanced spaceport. But when a drone returned after 14 local days, it brought only the IDs of the murdered, and no explanation of their connection to Opus Dei, or the motives for that organization's efforts on Mars. After 15 days of dust storm, more reports of continued Palestinian attacks on convoys and garrisons, and long days of interrogation and evidence sifting that led nowhere, The Grand Inquisitor was happy to hear Captain Walmack call on secure tight beam from the Jibreel to announce that there was an emergency that would require the Grand Inquisitor and his entourage to return to orbit as soon as possible. The Jibreel was one of the newest Archangel-class starships, and it looked functional and deadly to Cardinal Mustafa as their dropships closed the last few kilometers to rendezvous. The Grand Inquisitor knew little about Pax warships, but even he could see that Captain Walmack had morphed the starship to battle readiness. The various booms and sensor arrays had been drawn in beneath the starship's skin. The bulge of the Gideon drive had sprouted laser-reflective armor, and the various weapons portals were cleared for action. Behind the Archangel, Mars turned, a dust-shrouded disk the color of dried blood. Cardinal Mustafa hoped that this would be his last view of the place. Father Farrell pointed out that all 8 of the Mars System Task Force's torch ships were within 500 clicks of the Jibreel, a tight defensive grouping by space-going standards, and the Grand Inquisitor realized that something serious was in the offing. Mustafa's dropship was the first to dock, and Walmack met them in the airlock antechamber. The interior containment field gave them gravity.
"My apologies for interrupting your inquisition, Your Excellency," began the captain.
"Never mind that," said Cardinal Mustafa, shaking sand from the folds of his robe. "What is so important, Captain?" Walmack blinked at the entourage emerging from the airlock behind the Grand Inquisitor. Father Farrell, of course, followed by Security Commander Browning. 3 Holy Office aides, Marine Sergeant Nell Kastner, the Resurrection Chaplain Bishop Ertel, and Major Piet, the former Ground Force Commander whom Cardinal Mustafa had liberated from Governor Palo's service. The Grand Inquisitor saw the captain's hesitation.
"You can speak freely, Captain. All in this group have been cleared by the Holy Office."
Walmack nodded.
"Your Excellency, we have found the ship."
Cardinal Mustafa must have stared his incomprehension.
"The heavy-duty freighter that must have left Mars orbit the day of the massacre, Your Excellency," continued the captain. "We knew that their dropships had rendezvoused with some ship that day."
"Yes," said the Grand Inquisitor. "But we assumed that it would be long gone, translated to whatever star system it was bound for."
"Yes, sir," said Walmack. "But on the off chance that the ship had never spun up to C+, I had the dropships do an in-system search. We found the freighter in the system's asteroid belt."
"Was that its destination?" asked Mustafa.
The captain was shaking his head.
"I think not, Excellency. The freighter is cold and dead. It's tumbling. Our instruments show no life on board, no systems powered up, not even the fusion drive."
"But it is a starship freighter," questioned Father Farrell. Captain Walmack turned toward the tall, thin man.
"Yes, Father. The HHMS Saigon Maru, a 3-million-ton ore and bulk freighter that's seen service since the days of the hegemony."
"Mercantilis," the Grand Inquisitor said softly. Walmack looked grim.
"Originally, Your Excellency. But our records show that the Saigon Maru was decommissioned from the Mercantilis fleet and rendered into scrap metal 8 standard years ago."
Cardinal Mustafa and Father Farrell exchanged glances.
"Have you boarded the ship yet, Captain?" asked Commander Browning.
"No," said Walmack. "Because of the political implications, I thought it best if His Excellency were aboard and authorized such a search."
"Very good," said the Grand Inquisitor.
"Also," said Captain Walmack, "I wanted the full complement of Marines and Swiss Guard troopers aboard first."
"Why is that, sir?" asked Major Piet. His uniform looked bulky over his burn cast.
"Something's not right," said the captain, looking at the Major and then at the Grand Inquisitor. "Something's very much not right."
More than 200 light-years from Mars system, Task Force Gideon was completing its task of destroying Lucifer. The 7th and final ouster system in their punitive expedition was the hardest to finish off. A yellow G-type star with 6 worlds, 2 of them inhabitable without terraforming. The system was crawling with ousters. Military bases out beyond the asteroids. Birthing rocks in the asteroid belt. Angel environments around the innermost water world. Refueling depots in low orbit around the gas giant. And an orbital forest being grown between what would have been the orbits of Venus and Old Earth in the old Sol system. It took Gideon 10 standard days to search out and kill a majority of these nodes of ouster life. When they were done, Admiral Aldecacti called for a physical conference of the 7 captains aboard His Holiness's ship Uriel and revealed that the plans had been changed. The expedition had been so successful that they would seek out new targets and continue the attack. Aldecacti had dispatched a Gideon Drive drone to Pacham system and received permission to extend the mission. The 7 archangels would translate to the nearest Pax base, Tau Ceti system, where they would be rearmed, refitted, refueled, and joined by 5 new archangels. Probes had already targeted a dozen new ouster systems, none of which had yet received news of the massacre along Task Force Gideon's swath of destruction. Counting resurrection time, they would be attacking again within 10 standard days. The 7 captains returned to their 7 ships and prepared for the translation from target system Lucifer to Tau Ceti Center base. Aboard HHS Raphael, Commander Hogan Hoag Leibler was uneasy. Besides his official capacity as executive officer of the starship, second in command to Father Captain DeSoya, Leibler was paid to spy on the Father Captain and to report any suspicious behavior. First to the Chief of Holy Office Security aboard Admiral Aldecacti's flagship, the Uriel, and then, as far as the executive officer could tell, all the way up the chain of command to the legendary Cardinal Lourdesami. Leibler's problem at the moment was that he was suspicious but could not articulate the cause for his suspicions. The spy could hardly tight-beam the Uriel with the dangerous news that the crew of Father Captain DeSoya's Raphael had been going to confession too frequently. But that was precisely one of the causes of Leibler's concern. Of course, Hoag Leibler was not a spy by training or inclination. He was a gentleman of reduced circumstances, forced first by financial constraints to exercise a Renaissance minor gentleman's option of joining the military. And then constrained further, by loyalty to his Pax and church, he convinced himself, more than by the constant need for money to reclaim and restore his estates, into spying on his captain. The confessions were not all that out of the ordinary. The crew was made up of faithful, church and confession-going, born-again Christian soldiers, of course, and the circumstances in which they found themselves. The possibility of a true and eternal death if one of the ouster fusion weapons or K-beams made it through the defensive containment fields certainly added to the urgency of that faith. But Leibler sensed some extra factor at work in all these confessions since Target System Mammon. During the lulls in the vicious fighting here in Target System Lucifer, the entire crew and Swiss Guard complement of the Raphael, some 27 hands in all, not counting the bewildered executive officer, had been cycling through the confessional like spacers at an outback port whorehouse. And the confessional was the one place at which even the ship's executive officer could not linger and eavesdrop. Leibler could not imagine what conspiracy could possibly be afoot. Mutiny made no sense. First, it was unthinkable. No crew in the nearly 3 centuries of Pax fleet had ever mutinied, nor come close to mutiny. Second, it was absurd. Mutineers did not flock to the confessional to discuss the sin of a planned mutiny with the captain of the